With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for a dollar. Because saving with deals is always on the menu. With new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. Funny thing about being fast, you end up waiting a lot. First to show up, first in line, then just waiting. Me, I rev up Chumba Casino. With over 200 social casino games, no slow lanes here. Why sit around when you can spin?
Start your engine.
I'm already racing. Your turn. Play for free at ChumbaCasino.com. That's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Bunny Guinness, and this is my podcast, Bunny in the Garden, with someone special. Someone who is well known for something other than their green fingers, but who is also a mustard-keen gardener. I'll discover them through their garden, why, how, and when they garden, the best tips they've learnt, and their gardening style and approach. Today, I'm in the Norfolk Garden of organic gardener Bob Flowerdew. Bob has been on the Gardener's Question Time panel even longer than I have. He went to recording as a member of the audience, thought he could do better than the panel, and so contacted the producer. He was on Gardener's World for 3 years in 1995, wearing his signature boiler suit and with his long golden plait. Bob and I frequently disagree on Gardener's Question Time.
Usually, no, we always disagree.
Usually, amicably, we have quite a different approach. But I think every gardener knows there are many different takes on design, growing and making a gardener. Bob, it's lovely to be here. When I looked at your CV, I was a bit shell-shocked. You had worked in many different things before you became a professional gardener. You'd gained your glider's license, RAF marksman, private pilot licenses for old enough to drive a car, qualified scuba driver. And you also say, for a crust, I've been a chicken giblet washer, advanced to a chicken box counter, a council care home cleaner, dog impersonator, glass fibre laminator, houseboy and cook in houses of ill repute, festival security lighting engineer, marine engineer, museum attendant, nude model, Parisian guide, theatrical golfer, vitreous enamel applicator, arcade mechanic and pinball wizard. But you also have a financial qualification. That's what you started to do first. What was that?
Well, I originally started in sciences. I love science. And then
so that was science A-levels, you mean?
Sciences, yeah, A-levels. And then I went to college to do engineering.
Yes.
And I studied production engineering, how we make things, learned to weld, braise, use a lathe, how to cast iron and aluminium. Absolutely fascinating how everything is made. But I fell in love with the computer. It was one of those first years when computers had first arrived. There were only two in the country that could be used by students. It wasn't on a screen. It was still on teletype with punch tape and paper. I wrote a program in 1971, 72, a games program. The only thing was, with two computers in the country, I couldn't become Bill Gates because there wasn't anyone to sell it to. However, it was fun doing that. The problem was, at the time, there wasn't much you could do with a computer except basically accounts. So I changed over to a business studies course and qualified in financial management, cost accountancy, with economics and company law.
So that was an HND or what was that?
Well, it was, it was an honours degree.
Yes.
And I qualified in it. I did a year in London, in the city, and decided that I did not want to end up like other accountants and went off travelling.
That's interesting because if I look at you now and I look at the average financial accountant or financial guy, you are obviously the far opposite end of the scale. I mean, there you are. You've got your long plait, your beard. No way can I ever imagine you in a city slickers suit.
Well, but it wasn't a city slickers suit at the time. If you think back to when we're talking about, it was one of those with the rounded lapels, the kipper tie, the patent leather shoes. Really quite dapper times.
Yeah. Your CV did open my eyes, I must say. I didn't know this about you. I mean, I've worked with you for 25, 26 years, something like that, on Gardener's Question Time. And we always have very lively green room exchanges, shall we say. I always think, when I think of what really turns you on, what really floats your boat, is you love performing. You know, when you're on the panel and you make the audience laugh or you get a round of applause, you positively glow. And absolutely, you are, I think you were born a performer. And I often wonder, why did he not go on the stage or stand
but
up?
We are on the stage, Bunny.
Yeah, but full time, you know, not just gardening.
But again, look at the lifestyle. I remember Gary Rhodes, and he had, I think it was 32 bookings in less than that number of days virtually. And I thought, I don't want to be on the road staying in hotels every bloody night of the year. No. And I got into gardening because I loved gardening. I love growing things. I love eating my own food. And also, I realised way back that the world climate problem was serious and that we had to go to a society where we were growing more. I don't expect everyone to grow all their own. I expect there still be big farms producing the bulk things. But I wanted more people to be able to grow more of their own fruit and veg at the quality end. Forget about growing your own potatoes and carrots and onions. That's nice. Grow strawberries and grapes and watermelons and oranges. Those are the things that make the quality in life.
So your mission really now is, well, you were one of the early adopters of organic gardening, weren't you? And you really pushed it. And now many, many people are following in your wake. And that is probably your mission in life now, would you say? Or has been for the last 25?
Since I left college, that yeah. I really feel that we all should be doing more gardening. Work 3 days a week, have 2 days to spend with your family and 2 days in the garden. Absolute perfect combination.
But my son, when I bang on about this to my son, I don't, not quite like that, I have to say. He says, but that's fine for you. You've got a space. You've got 3/4 of an acre here. I could lose myself in my garden on only 1/2 acre all my life, every day of the week. But many of us live in tiny little pocket handkerchief spaces. And to be honest, if you spent 2 days a week in there, well, you couldn't. There's just not enough.
But you chose where you live. You chose the job you took. You chose the car you bought. Choose a house with a garden. Simple.
Yes, I won't.
It's an economic choice you make.
It's
early
an economic
on.
Choice.
I chose to live humbly and to have my time in the garden.
Yeah.
I could have earned 10 times as much. I was earning far more in my other careers.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. Yeah. You can't eat money.
Yeah. But I mean, in UK, we've got relatively large gardens per capita. But when I go and work in Japan and in China and things, people don't have the luxury of space like we have. You know, this is a luxury.
Yes.
But you're preaching mainly to us.
Most people choose to move to a town or choose to move into a house because of the work. I chose to be out in the country where land is available. Everyone does not have that choice because there isn't enough available.
Yeah.
But then most people, as you say, don't want that. Therefore, they don't want it, they don't have it. But those who want it can have it if they choose to. It's a bit like, you know, I do find the sour grapes that people say, oh, but there isn't enough organic food for everybody. Well, then let's grow more. There isn't enough land. Well, then let's repackage the way we're doing it. Because right now, we're talking about taking agricultural land and putting far too many houses per acre on it. I would rather take more land out of agriculture and give people large gardens they didn't tend, because then they would be rewilded. And a garden that is just rewilded is far more use to nature than a bit of agricultural greenbelt.
Well, go back to your CV, though. I won't take you up on that one. You were also booed off the stage at Glastonbury in 1977. Now, were you singing? What were you doing to be booed off? I didn't hear about that.
Oh, yeah, well, I was at Glastonbury selling carpet bags for a charity that reforested the Sahara. Because what had happened was I was working in a boat building factory in on the Suffolk-Norfolk border, and it was miserable. And I thought, and I saw an advert in the paper, wanted tree planters for the Sahara. And I thought, absolutely perfect. My God, it's going to be hot and sunny. So I signed up, and they sent me to look after the headquarters in Bury St Edmunds, which was not really the Sahara. And however, they made carpet products, and we went to the festival to sell carpet cushions, carpet bags made out of recycled carpet. And while I was there talking to Guy, there was a big gap between the bands playing on the stage. And I was talking about that, and he said, oh, yeah, people go up and play. You know, they don't mind, it's open mic. So I went up and said to the guys, I've got some poetry, could I go on open mic? He said, yeah, here you go, here's a mic, off you go. So while they're changing the sets, I go up and start reading the poetry, which was protest poetry of the time. And they started booing because, it's bringing us down, man, it's heavy.
Oh, Oh, Bob. Oh,
because
Bob.
It was too much about the way we're destroying the planet, you know.
Right. I've always thought you had a photographic memory.
One of the things I'm blessed with is an incredibly good memory. I can actually almost remember every question in the village hall it was asked in.
Yeah.
Not the ones that we asked every time, because obviously they come up too often. But an unusual question, as soon as you tell me that, I'm back where it was asked. And I think one of the things we all do is we don't exercise ourselves enough from when we're early on. And I taught my kids this. Repetition, learn things, because learning is like any other muscle. The more you learn, the easier it is to learn.
Interesting. And the other thing that reading your CV opened my eyes, you won a brothel call in Barbados. I didn't even know there were such things. And when you win
it's like a pub. It's like a pub crawl, but slightly changed to suit the conditions. Yeah,
exactly. So I won't ask how many.
I can't remember how many either, because it started with a pub crawl.
Now you see, he's then his flaky memory is flaky. At times when
he
wants
it
to be.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Never in a court of law.
So was your father a vicar or a farmer?
My father was a farmer, but he was high church, and so he was also, what do they call it? I've forgotten the name for it now.
Lay preacher?
A lay preacher, and he was also, I've forgotten the other thing, when they look after the church. He did a lot of that stuff.
And so was your father a keen gardener? Because farmers are notoriously bad farmers.
Have you ever known a good farmer and gardener?
Exactly.
However, he did actually, because we were very poor, very, very poor. And I know everybody nowadays, I had a pub. I was born in a house without electric, water, telephone, toilet, anything. It was just a hovel. We were so poor, it was ridiculous. My father shouldn't have tried carrying on farming. The farm was too small for
him.
How
big was the farm?
150 acres, but it was trying to support three families. And
three families? He had lots
families.
Who's that? His father?
His father, his sister, and his uncle, his brother, my uncle, and my grandmother, who they were buying it off. They couldn't make it work. And so he did have a vegetable garden where he grew the basics. But you know how a farmer grows basics.
Yeah.
Reverse a trailer load of muck and plant through it, and that's it. Come back and harvest. And I kind of like that approach. I think that often we make much of our work too complicated. Most of the books are about how to produce beautiful looking things for the prize bench, or how to make the people in the big house happy with what you've sent up, not how to grow stuff for yourself easily. And that's a classic example is when I go to give a talk, people want to know how to grow leeks. They don't want to know how to grow leeks like a leek champion to produce things the size of your leg. They'd love to produce one to show the friends, but they don't want to cook them. What they want is, how can I grow leeks as good as Tesco's for 5 minutes work a year? That's the real question we should be answering.
So did you work on that garden? Did you garden it, or did your father?
Oh, I had to do it. You grow up on a farm, you do chores. So And very early on, my first sales as a gardener were, I planted bolted onions and then cleaned them up once they'd grown and sold them as spring onions in my grandmother's shop.
So bolted onions, when they produce the little sort of seed bits at the top, and then you planted them up, just for people who don't know this.
Mm. No, onions that have started to grow.
Yes.
In the spring,
Which
will go to a seed head, but at the stage when they first got three leaves, are actually spring onions inside a decaying bulb. So you take the decaying bulb off, and now you've got a spring onion to sell.
Oh, right, so it's basic spring onions, yeah. So when did you actually start gardening for a living? How old were you?
Well, for a living? That was...
Professionally?
Professionally is when I came here, because then I needed to earn a living. I worked in Norwich in a computer firm for a while, because that seemed... But the problem is, when you work for a living 9 to 5, it's not 9 to 5. First of all, it was 8 to 5, and then, of course, you've got an hour each way. It doesn't leave you much time for the garden.
So how old were you when you moved here?
Oh, about 30.
So you started gardening quite late in life, really?
Well, no, because I've been growing things with aunts, with grandmother.
Yeah.
You know,
but
I've always been around garden. My aunts, my grandmother, they grew flowers. My father, say, grew vegetables. My grandfather, over here in Dickleborough, he had a small holding. He had pigs, he had chickens, he had all those things. So I grew up very much in the growing stuff. The zeitgeist of it was you grew stuff and ate it. Particularly the processing and storing, something that people seem to have forgotten so much about. You know, I've always loved making my own jams, my jellies, and I've been doing that since I was less than a teenager. In fact, when we finally did actually get the house extended, I was 7 or 8, and we put a proper bathroom toilet on, connected up to the mains, we had electric, it was modern. And we had this lovely new kitchen, lovely new second hand, but Rayburn, and Mother was making, with my help, blackcurrant jam. And what did I do? I pulled the top off the pressure cooker to see what would happen. You know the little pressure thing?
And it went mad.
And it went up through the whole lot, ejected, and gave the whole room a tie-dye purple spraying. Brand new, whitewashed walls, completely ruined.
My mother did the same with spinach soup, green version of that. So, and when did you go organic? And who persuaded you? Because presumably your father on his farm would have been, in those days, I mean, they were using DDT and
My God, they used all sorts. My father got terrible rashes on his legs from having walked through fields on the way back from spraying.
Yeah.
And so his legs got wet with the spray, and then for the rest of his life he kept coming up in rashes there. It's quite a coincidence, because the Soil Association was founded at Hawley near Stowmarket, which is only 5 miles over the fields from where we lived on Waveney Valley. And I used to go round. I got lifts in. My parents couldn't stand having me around. I never shut up. So they'd give me to friends or take me off with them. And one of them was a local delivery driver. He picked up stuff from our farm and then delivered it to other farms. And amongst them were these strange people who were muck and magic and who crossed between witchcraft and communism. And they lived out there at Hawley. Well, they didn't look any different to any other Suffolk farmers I came across. They had the same clothes, the same way of life. The animals looked the same. The stock looked pretty similar. So all these people going on about weirdos, they looked no weirder than any other Suffolk farmers. So I came across organic early on. Then when I was working, as I said, for that charity in Bury St Edmunds, there they were very pro-organic. And the guy there was getting his bread sent up from London on the train from Ceres, because it was the only place where you could buy organic bread at the time. And they showed me some good reading. And then when I travelled around America, and I came across organic supermarket in 1978. We hardly had supermarkets here, let alone big ones, and they had an organic one. And I could see the sense of it. The more I read about it, the more I understood about it, that it made a lot of sense. And so that was when I became convinced that we had to go, not necessarily the whole world had to go organic, but much of it had to.
And what age were you then when you got that?
That would be about 25, something like that.
But you started gardening here 30 years ago.
But I've been gardening at my last place in North Norfolk when I was working in the arcades and so on.
Okay.
But not professionally. Mm. I only started professionally because people asked me to give them what I was doing here. And they saw what, you know, I used to give talks about gardening to local people, and then they'd ask me to come and help them out. And that's really how I started with the professional side of it.
And who has always been your hero in the organic movement? I mean, Seymour, how do you rate someone like that? Or
Lawrence Hills, I think, HDRA. William Cobbett as well. Because although he wasn't organic, it was too early. I mean, he's Victorian. His attitude, don't read the books and believe them. Test it for yourself. And I loved that. He was so much hands-on. He really did work out things for himself. And that's what you have to do.
Yeah, William Cobbett's had a lot of followers nowadays, current people, aren't they? I think Guy Singh Watson says that, and quite a few people. So you don't... where do you think the organic movement is going? Do you think it is growing? Is it what percentage of you garden?
What do you mean?
What percentage of gardeners do you think follow organic principle?
I think that what's happened is that it was Prince Charles who came over that really changed it all. It stopped people saying it was a lunatic fringe. It made people think about it.
Yeah.
The game was won when Heinz produced organic baked beans. To me, that was, okay, we got there. Right? When a company the size of Heinz is producing organic baked beans, the game has been won in the sense of we're now real. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Since then...
When was that? When did Heinz
produce? We're talking 20 years ago.
Right, yeah.
However, the number of organic products is still there, but they're harder to find because everyone's being more economic nowadays, and there's, you know, economic brands are being pushed, and so people are possibly cutting back on that. But what about... How many people in the garden are organic? Not many. How many people are greener than they were 30 years ago? Almost everybody.
Yeah.
That's the big difference. The organic movement hasn't turned everyone organic. it's turned most people away from using those poisons and the things that were really destroying everything in our gardens. People no longer pile on the fertilizer, pile on the herbicides, the fungicides, spray every weed. We've become greener in our attitude to the living things in our garden. Everyone wants to have more butterflies and birds. That's where we've changed, and that's wonderful.
Yeah, I remember one of the head gardeners at Highgrove before Deb's Goodenough. He used to say, it's no good being partially organic, you've got to be totally. But I actually think that's wrong because it's alienating a whole lot.
Exactly.
I think
you move people in the right direction.
Yeah,
eat 100%, I don't eat 100% organic, for goodness sake. There are a few things that I can't get that I love that are not organic. You know, like Turkish Delight. I haven't yet found one for that. I haven't found an organic halva. I love that too. So I eat non-organic. But what I try and do is the same as I would for an animal. If you have pigs or chickens, they have to have 80-90% organic food, and there's a 10% derogation to allow other things. So I allow myself a derogation of 10-15%. So the
That is the case with pigs, is it? When you're selling an organic pig?
Yeah, because it's certain things have always been difficult to get, and you also want to give them treats and balance the diet. So there's always been an allowance of a small percentage that can be non-organic.
Didn't realise. So my pigs probably are organic because,
I haven't looked at the current standards recently, but when I looked at the standards and used to stick to them, like, which was, 20 years ago, I was inspected here, so that I came up to organic standards. The point is that the methods I'm using and everything are organic, it's that I occasionally buy in stuff that isn't organic. And the same for my children. I cannot get them to have only organic food. They want, you know, an X's burger or an X's chicken nuggets. To be fair, they also say that my food tastes better when they have it. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts. You can't push people to be 100% organic. That would be foolish. Get them to improve the diet. That's much easier.
Yeah, because it is extraordinary because you have the organic side and then you have the mass amount of food that's made with chemicals, additives, preservatives. And I'm sure far more people eat that junk food. And we're only beginning to realise now that all these additives and things are not good for your microbiome. They really affect you. It's got a long hill to climb, really, hasn't it? Because that food, which is pushed on television, you would never see something natural, organic pushed on television. It's only the highly processed stuff.
Well, because they make the money on those.
If
they didn't push them, people wouldn't buy them.
Yeah.
Basically, we have a system whereby people, big companies, get rich making people sick, and then the same companies own the pharmacy companies that produce the pills that make people well again. I do think there's a lot of vested interest in the world towards not letting us become greener. It doesn't mean there's a conspiracy. I just think that it's basically people looking after their own profit margins.
Yeah, and it also slightly amuses me when people who are organic, then you look under their sink and it's full of chemicals to clean
the
house.
Have a look under my sink if you want.
Yeah, and then also they've got these gas guzzlers.
I have a Ford Focus. I have to have a car. I wouldn't have a car if I could, but living out here in the country, I still need one.
But you did have a big gas guzzling
until
BMW.
I realized, may I just
many
point
years.
Out that I had a gas guzzler by your terms. However, it did 27 miles per gallon.
That's appalling.
27.
That's appalling.
Now it is, but at the time it wasn't. Right.
Right. We won't go into our usual arguments.
I agree absolutely. I sold it.
Good boy.
20 years ago as well, you know. But I enjoyed it. I was a petrol head.
I will admit it.
It was a V12.
He said it.
I was a petrol head. I'm not anymore. It's the same thing, you know. We have to change. I haven't been as green as I am all my life. When I was a kid, I had a motorcycle, you know. And yes, it does a few miles per gallon, but it's not. I wouldn't ever get on a motorcycle now. The world has changed. You know? It's a different place.
I always remember you came into one recording and you just had an argument with Tesco's over their bag for life.
Oh, my God. Yes, I am still boycotting them. We're now 15 years down the line.
So just to recap, Bob bought a bag for life from Tesco's and the thing burst after
how many
years?
The handle's pulled off.
After how many years?
2 years.
He'd probably put a deep freeze in it or something.
Getting my shopping. The handle's pulled off. I asked for another one. They refused.
And he had this long altercation.
Yeah, I had two little kids. My little kids were 5, 6, running around. My wife's in hospital. And this woman jumped up, little one, said, no, no, it's a bag for life. You bought it, you have to buy another one. I said, you sold it to me as a bag for life. I'd already had troubles with them when they refused to take a chicken back that hadn't been eviscerated properly. Still had the guts inside it. And they were arguing underneath the no quibble sign. We have a no quibble. I said, you have a no quibble sign and you're quibbling and there's bloody guts in this chicken. Next time I go back, the handles pull off this thing. They won't give me a replacement bag. I apologise to the people in the queue behind me. And I continue to say, under the Sale of Goods Act, I'm entitled to expect anything that I buy to have a reasonable life. I don't expect a bag to pull apart after a couple of years to have a reasonable life. So not only do I have the right to it under the Bag for Life, I have a right to it under the Sale of Goods Act. Would you like to go to court over it? She told me to stop being a git. And I told her, well, if she didn't give me the bag for life, I would not use them again. And I haven't been back to Tesco's Indus now for... My kids were about 4 or 5, they're now 18, so 13 or 14 years. They have lost a huge amount of turnover for one bag.
Right.
Stand your ground, folks. Do not let them walk over you. If you have rights, demand them, because if you don't demand and live and ask for your rights, they will not be there.
So I think the listeners can probably understand why in the green room we do have quite heated discussions. And
what
they go on for one recording.
What I find amazing is that we don't know the questions, do we, Bunny? They go off and choose the questions, so we have no idea what the questions are going to be.
Yeah.
And yet, how many times have we discussed something in the green room, they can't hear us, and yet that's a question about that comes up. Sometimes I think we're psychic. You know, really is quite amazing.
You are obviously known for recycling. So what would you say is the most unusual thing or the most pertinent, the best thing you've recycled?
Oh, without doubt, the thing that I think most people should do, and that I do, is pee on the bloody compost heap. Stop sending it down to the North Sea with 2 gallons of drinking water. That is the best recycling you can do. It's fertiliser for free. Dilute it down and feed your plants. If you've got nowhere else, put it on the lawn. Recycle your pee. Stop wasting a wonderful resource.
But can I just add, don't put it neat on your lawn, because if you're like Bob, you'll have little yellow patches all over it. So dilute it.
But I do not have little yellow patches all over my lawn.
If you peed on your lawn, Bob,
I don't pee on my lawn because I said.
Oh, but you just said.
I just said you can pee on your lawn.
Oh, but not without diluting.
I wouldn't. I don't try and make my lawn grow, then I have to cut it more often. Yeah. I mean, this is one of the insanities that you get, is that people spend a fortune trying to make the lawn look better, and then they complain about the amount of work they've had to spend on it.
I quite agree. That is bonkers. But, Bob, I do, I'm with you on that one.
Write it down, folks.
Get too excited. But I have even, someone's developed a watering can, because it's fine for you guys. You can just pull your spigot out and wang it on. But for us, it's slightly more difficult.
There's a thing that they use for training babies. You just slip it in the toilet. You lift the seat, put this bowl in, you pee in the bowl, lift the seat, take it out, tip it in.
Right, lovely.
Bottle.
Okay, yeah. So, no, I do think urine is amazing stuff. And it is sterile as it comes out of your body. My son's a medic.
Except for hepatitis. No, but if you've got hepatitis, you probably know about it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Highgrove, okay, King Charles's garden, where you mentioned, the king being really... He's been organic for a long time, hasn't he? Certainly when he started Highgrove, which was about nearly, it was 40 years ago, I think, wasn't it? And he was one of the first ones that really gave it some welly. You and him together, I think, have done a very good job. But he says his is a closed system, i.e. he doesn't bring anything in apart from sand. So therefore, he doesn't bring in fertilizers. He uses, that's why he cuts and collects his lawn, because he uses the organic matter from the grass and things like that. But I have to say, he does bring in plants.
Well, of course. Yeah, I mean, and seeds.
And seed, yeah, exactly. But yours isn't a closed system, is it? Or is it?
Very, very close.
Very, very,
very
close.
Very, very close. Yeah. I don't bring in manures. I make compost.
Yeah.
I grow a lot of elderberries, just in order to break off the young stems to add to the compost. I grow a lot of nettles, again, for the compost material. I buy in maybe a litre of seaweed solution a year. I don't use fertilisers. I don't use pesticides. Very little comes in at all.
Yeah.
The irony of it is that over the years, I've always wanted to test my own sowing and potting compost to see how good they are. And I've also always tested conventional ones that are easily available from the local garden centres to see how they compare and what other people are using. And one of the things that I found years ago was that the commercial ones are often not that good, and that my organic homemade ones were as good and free. And then the peat debate came, and of course I then had to test peat-based compost against others. I ended up buying more peat-based compost to do the trials than I had in my entire life the rest of the time. And to be honest, I am not a fan of peat, but at the same time I do think that people really misjudge the peat argument. It's not about whether or not we use peat in horticulture, it's whether or not we re-wet the peat bogs. That's the problem. A dried out peat bog is losing carbon dioxide to the atmosphere at a phenomenal rate. If we re-wet it, it starts absorbing it again. The argument about peat in horticulture is irrelevant. It's re-wetting the uplands so that they are no longer drained for agriculture. Re-wetting the peat bogs, that is the crucial thing. But we've got the everyone's got it the wrong way around and starts worrying about it.
Well,
We don't need it in horticulture anyway. It is, to my mind, almost irrelevant. But we need to get back to the facts. The facts are the peat bogs are dried out and they really are giving off a lot of carbon dioxide instead of fixing it. Simple solution, re-wet them.
So I think the most people who know about peat totally agree with that. Mm. And the whole peat argument we won't go into here because it would be for hours.
Well, it got me on the front page of the New York Times. Do you know that? I made the front page of the New York Times. Do you know about the story about this?
Well, can we just go back to the peat thing first? So, and it's something like the amount of peat used in horticulture is 0.005% or something. Mm. And when in Ireland, my son lives in Ireland, and lots of people use peat on their fires in Dublin.
Yeah.
But what they do is they nibble around the edge of the bogs, which reduces the water table, so the peat dies. Whereas if they re-wetted and restored those, that would pretty much solve the problem.
Well, look at the Norfolk Broads. They are old peat workings, and they are the most wonderful ecosystem there is in East Anglia.
Yeah.
And that's all it is. It's an old one that was dug out and flooded. I'm not suggesting we dig out the peat bogs. I'm just suggesting we reflood them.
Yeah.
But coming back, this was wonderful. It was when we had an early producer on Gardener's Question Time, and he'd had enough of us, and he went to New York to get away from us for a break. And he woke up in the morning, and the newspaper shoved under his door had my mug right on the front of it, the New York Times, with me staring up at him. He'd gone to get away from us, and there I am following him around. And that was all about the peat debate. And they can't understand why we have such vitriol over using it in horticulture, because they're still burning it in power stations.
As they were in Ireland.
And indeed, I have heard that some of our places that used to burn coal that are now burning substitutes, that they can, it's wood pellets, comes from North America, and apparently they use some peat in some of those to bind them together. So we may still be burning peat but not realising it.
Yeah. No, the peat argument I think has been taken up by social media, by the people who don't understand the argument.
Yeah.
But I think the horticultural industry will suffer because if we don't, our growers in the UK aren't allowed to use it. At the moment, they still are. Mm-hmm. We import it from Holland and France.
That's why it's used, is because it's light and therefore you can put twice and as many plants on a truck. Yeah.
And also, it is better. So far, we have not yet developed something to match it.
Well, if you read Lawrence and Newell, who did the original potting compost at Rothamsted, they reckoned that leaf mould was actually better. It just didn't last as long as peat, and it wasn't available in any quantity.
So that's the downside. That's a big downside,
Yeah,
Bob.
But the point is that if you're making your own, you can make leaf mould compost.
If you're making
your
own.
And that's the whole thing.
Yeah.
Make your own. It's not difficult. How much do you need, for goodness sake? If you trim the edges off the lawn, trim the edges of grass where they're growing over the concrete slabs in the path, collect those up, rot them down in a bag. Collect up the leaves, rot them down in a bag, mix them together with some molehill soil and some compost necessary. Get some compost. You can always microwave it to sterilise it so there aren't so many seeds in it. You can make a fantastic homemade compost for free.
With the microwave, you will kill all the lovely bugs and things in it, which you want.
Because what you want to do is to get rid of the seeds.
Yeah.
No, of course I use unsterilized compost for potting most of the time, but you do not want a load of seeds of weeds coming up with something you don't recognize. So for sowing compost, you really do need a sterile compost. So I'm with you there.
I like a sterile compost to sow. But the thought of putting compost in a microwave and killing all
makes me... The thought of putting my compost in the microwave is not a problem for me, but it is for my wife.
I'm not surprised. Poor woman.
She doesn't
Poor
know
woman.
About it going in the Rayburn the rest of the time and being baked in the oven.
So, as we know, Bob, you quite like controversy. Now, the one with hedgehogs, did you like that one or not? That was a bit...
I love hedgehogs, but I don't think they're the gardener's friend. Quite simply, if you examine hedgehog droppings, they're full of beetle bits, right? They don't like slugs particularly, and slugs can give them lungworm, so they don't eat a lot of slugs or snails. They eat beetles. Beetles, most beetles, particularly the ones on the ground, are useful friends. One beetle will eat 30 or 40 snail's eggs. So if you have a hedgehog eating the beetle doesn't eat the snail eggs, and you get more snails. So I'm not sure the hedgehog is a friend. However, I would still love to have them in, just like the blackbirds. They steal my bloody cherries, but I still love to hear them sing. I love to see the hedgehogs. They're great. However, we shouldn't fool ourselves, yeah? They are not necessarily helping.
Well, I'll leave the listener to decide there, because I think, to be honest, we used to have a lot and they have definitely diminished.
Oh, God, I used to have 3 or 4 come in every night to eat the cat's food. Right? Couldn't stop them, you know. And now I don't see those. I've only seen one this year.
Yeah, I think it's really sad. And also, badgers eat hedgehogs. And people don't realise that. Yeah. And we protect the badger like mad, but he's scuffling up our hedgehogs, as do dogs. Yeah. And badgers, I mean, the only predator is the motor car.
We don't have many badgers around here, fortunately. Maybe because I'm in the middle of a shooting estate.
Yeah.
If you think that all around is cereal lands and shooting lands. Yeah. So that I very rarely have seen a badger or a dead one on the road. Though I did have rather a nice idea. There was some local people were complaining awfully about the number of birds that the... you know we've got some wind turbines down the road?
Yeah.
They were saying that those were killing birds. And I went down there. It's on an old airfield. I used to live near it. And I never saw any dead birds underneath it. But what I did was every time I used to go on a GQT on a long distance in the car and I saw a dead badger, I'd pick it up and leave it underneath the wind turbine, hoping that some idiots would say, the wind turbine's killing badgers, we've got to stop them.
So you don't like badgers?
Well, that's a part of the ecology, I have no problem. But again, we've got the wrong end of it. Badgers are actually not giving TB to cows and vice versa. They are both contracting them from worms from fallen stock. When a cow in the past died, they buried them, especially if you're in a country, in the West Country or in Scotland, where there isn't many abattoirs that will take fallen stock. So they buried them. Pasteur showed that worms bring up germs from buried corpses. My belief is that the worms bring up the TB organisms, and then both the badgers and the cows eat the worms and get infected by the worms. And killing the badgers... Why does it suddenly cause an increase in some areas in TB? It's because they're not eating the worms. So there's more worms in the grass for the cows to eat. So what we need to do is look into this connection, not try to shoot the badgers, because I don't think they in themselves are a problem. But as you know, yes, they do love a hedgehog, and they are the only natural predator of a hedgehog, other than the motor car.
So I mean, I think it's very complex, TB and cattle. And so I'm not going to agree or disagree.
Every ecosystem is complex.
Yeah. Yeah, and with my cattle, you know, moving them, luckily we only have to be tested every 4 years. We're not a high TB area. But for some people in a high TB area, it just makes life very difficult as a cattle farmer. Does your wife and children, do they help you in the garden?
Never.
Have you ever got your children gardening?
When they were little, yes, but you can't call it help, can you? No. I mean, it's actually time-consuming, but it's teaching them, and they learn things about it. And from when they were little, one of the things I do believe is we don't use our senses enough. I love the scent of perfumed plants and the smell of leaves, the smell of the dew. And from when they were little, tiny little babies, I used to bring in scented flowers and hold them under the nose and tell them the names. And they really did enjoy that. And then when they first went to school, they ran across the room and they came back... Daddy, they're plastic flowers. And I was so touched. I thought, yes, I've got them. They they're into burgers and chicken nuggets at the moment, but they know what good food tastes like. They know what the flowers smell like. They know what fresh fruit tastes like. Well, as soon as they're grown a little older, a little more mature, they will come back to the real things, and that's what's important. They've got the grounding. And as to my wife, my previous live-in lover, who was here for 7 years, was great, wonderful, helped in the garden a lot, but she kept doing things her way. And if I'm writing about it and talking about it, I need it to be done my way. And I'm afraid that...
You fell out over that, and I remember
No, we
that.
Didn't fall out, but it was a definite point that it was not helping that my writing and all the rest have somebody doing things in the garden which were not what I was asking her to do or when she wanted to do them. She was great, she was wonderful, but I wasn't doing it all. It's the same way, I don't mind having somebody come in and help me cut a hedge. That's just for safety and take it easy. But if I'm going to be sowing things, I want to know that I'm sowing them and how I'm sowing them, because that's what I write about. And
but Bob,
now let me just finish.
Yeah.
We didn't fall out over it. We fell out because she decided she really loved the Caribbean and wanted to stay there after a holiday. Fine. My next one, though, I did choose someone who didn't have much of an interest in the outside life, because I decided I would rather garden my own garden. And the same with the children. It would be nice to have them come out and give me a hand occasionally. But actually, I much prefer being in the garden with my cats, the birds, the butterflies, just me and God, if you like.
Right, right. But I do remember you saying that she asked for a bit of her own garden, the first, well, not the first necessarily, but the one before the current. Mm-hmm. And you said no, because it's my garden, it's my work, I want to write about it, and you wouldn't let her.
No, I offered her some of the beds.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, but the problem is that it was a holistic design, and to take a chunk out of it. But I was willing to compromise. That wasn't a great problem.
Okay.
It wasn't a great problem. It's just that, isn't it one of the things that we get so often on gardeners' question? How do you divide the garden up between you and your partner?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it comes. We don't get asked it, but it comes in the questions regularly, and we're told, oh, we've got another half dozen of those. It is one of the problems, and I think it is better to have your own bit. And certainly, one look after the front, one look after the back or whatever, because then it is your garden.
Mm. Interesting. I think there are cases definitely where they do it together, but they are few and far between. I mean, my husband used to be a farmer before he became an accountant, and so if you can't do it with a combine harvester, he's not interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I love that. Yeah. I really like that, because he does lie on the deck chair and say, I think you should just do this. And he actually comes up with quite good ideas. And I like having his ideas and things. Mm-hmm. And I very much like that I do it on myself without his help.
Going back to it, a garden, ideally, there will be couples who get on fine, right? Who work together wonderfully. That's great. But for most of us, I think a garden is your place where you go to be on your own. And some people want the company of an allotment. They want to be able to sit down and have cups of tea and coffee. For me, I just like losing myself in the job, taking on a task, and for the next 2 or 3 hours, I'm totally immersed in it. To me, that is wonderful. That's, I could not be happy. No, it's not happiness, it's contentment.
Mm. No, I totally agree there, actually, but I think it's because it's our profession as well, and so we do it full bore, There's nothing half-hearted about the way you or I garden. It's like a totally consuming passion stroke job. But so how much time do you spend a week actually gardening, as opposed to writing about it, whatever you do, talking about it, actually physically doing it?
Well, it's been a little strained the last few years because the children being teenagers have required taxi driving and all the rest, but now they're about to go off to college, so time will come back. I've also, I'm not quite as fit and strong as I was 30 years ago, so I'm going a bit slower. So it's changing. However, it's still wonderful. It's still what I want to do every day I get up. But I have to write. I have to write articles for money. That's what my main earning is, talking and writing. So I try to do those in the morning, because I think you're brighter in the morning. Mm. And then as soon as lunch comes, I have a light lunch and out in the garden almost every day of the year. Mm. Because, as you know, the best work is done in winter. That's when you really make the changes. People think gardening's a summer. No, I try to do it all in winter, so in the summer I can just, like now, I let it grow. I just let it all go where I can. I cut the grass where it needs it. I weed where it's absolutely essential. But I love just to let it grow in topsy. And then, come the autumn, I tidy it all up again and make it. That, to me, It's when it's growing is when it's just the most wonderful.
So just sitting in Bob's garden here, it's 3/4 acre. It's densely planted. So each of it is divided into little areas and you couldn't see from one end to the other at any point.
Oh, it was designed like that.
Yeah.
There is no way you can see all. You should never have a garden where you can see it all. Or even a path should always have a bend in it or something so that there's always something round the corner. And I spent more time the first year on paper, putting things in on paper, moving them around, trying to decide what, because there's an awful lot of design, putting things in the right places. So the pears on the wall, you know, little thing. Other people might have put an apricot or a peach, but then they require so much more pruning. The vegetable bed, they're aligned north-south. Yes, that was a problem because there's 40 of them. They're 5 foot by 15 foot. It's a huge area. But I actually aligned the whole square within the garden so that the beds are north-south so they get equal sunlight on either side.
And so what's the total area of veg on in your veg beds?
Well, it's 70 foot by 50 foot. So
right.
It's,
you know, and so how self-sufficient are you? So you've got that...
Well, the anchovy crop's pretty miserable. The truffles don't come in. I do not believe in being self-sufficient. I believe in being self-sustaining, whereby I buy in. I have grown my wheat, winnowed it, used a hand mill to turn it to flour, winnowed that, turned it into bread. It took about a week to make one decent loaf.
Mm.
It's no point. I buy bread or buy the flour and make bread. I grow all my potatoes. I grow all my carrots, my onions, those things. I grow nearly all the fruit. I do buy in fruit juice. I do buy in things that I can't get. My marzipan crop has been pretty poor most years. So I buy the luxuries, the things that I can't get in my own garden. And some things I could make. I used to make my own tomato ketchup. But to be honest, Heinz organic tomato ketchup is so damn good, I'd rather buy the stuff and save the effort and put the tomatoes in the freezer for making into a spaghetti bolognese or something. You know, sometimes you have to draw the line. I used to make piccalilli, and to be honest, I've given up making piccalilli. It was just so much extra work for the amount that I actually wanted.
But it is delicious. Homemade piccalilli.
Oh, God, it's by far. But
much,
the point
much
is, I only want one jar, and to do one jar is a lot. You see, the others don't like it. So one of the problems with a family is you're actually trying to cope with their tastes as well. And as they're now being off to college, I will be able to go back to my own, which is far, far more mixed salads. I used to chomp my way through huge quantities of mixed salads. Kids aren't particularly into salads. So what's the point in making them while they're here? I got into big trouble once at a talk to some nutritionists because I said that I put a spoonful of golden syrup in my coleslaw.
I was shocked when you told me that.
Yeah, but it makes the kids eat more coleslaw. And the point is they're getting carrots, onions, cabbage, an apple, raw. Surely more of that is better than less of that and less sugar. Put
well,
a little bit of a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down.
But we've had this argument before, everybody who's listening, just in case you still are. And I think you are making their taste buds go for sweet things. So the best thing
I'm
making
it. They've got everything. Do you know, it took me so long to get them off the lemonades that all the friends kept giving them. You wouldn't believe the number of empty lemonade bottles I saved up and have been using. Now they don't drink lemonade anymore. Thank God for that.
I always remember with my children, I tried no sugar and I used to do homemade bread and all this stuff. And then once they went out and they had sliced mother's pride process and they came back and they said, we had this amazing bread, sliced mother's pride. And then one day my daughter, when she was about 10, I found bowls of icing sugar under her bed. So I've been training her palate with no sugar and she had this craving. But my medic son with his children, my grandchildren, they are very strict with no sugar. And I think training the palate is key. But it's difficult because of the external influences. Yeah. And I think it's pretty much impossible.
What it is, it's no good going two steps forward and three steps back. But if you can make two steps forward and only one step back, you're winning.
Right.
And so, to my mind, it's, you know, there's several words are missing from our modern vocabulary. One is pragmatic, i.e., you got to make it work. The second is appropriate, i.e., what you're doing is actually appropriate to what you're trying. And then there's proportionate. that you're actually applying something to the degree to which it really is proportionate and correct to be doing so. And we've kind of gotten this. Everybody wants to be either, you're either this or you're that. You're on this side or you're that side. You're black or you're white. You're left or you're right. Everything is didactic and it's split into the two, right? And we're at each other's throats over things when actually everything is 50 shades of grey.
And on that line, I also remembered you being pilloried. I think it was George Monbiot or someone.
Monbiot, but he criticised me because he said
you're growing pineapples in your polytunnel.
I was wasting fuel and energy by growing pineapples in my polytunnel. Yep. I was trying to find out the minimum temperatures at which you can keep all these things alive because the Victorian gardeners didn't. They had a job to protect. So therefore they played safe. Over the years, I have reduced the temperature down in my double.
And what is your? What can they withstand? And
they can actually withstand zero for overnight,
for a short time,
providing they're dry.
Yeah.
And I had a pineapple plant hanging as an air plant in the ceiling, and another one floating in a container of water as a water plant, and they both survived as long as the temperature was above 60 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right.
If it drops below that, and they're wet or damp, they go.
Because it is interesting you say that, because you know the Riverford veg guy, Guy Singh Watson, who is the biggest organic veg box grower in the country, and he says with his tomatoes, if he actually grows them under heat in the UK, it's less, definitely worse carbon footprint than bringing them in from Spain.
Yes, but there's a question of what you're applying it to. I'm not just growing a pineapple. I'm not growing them at the moment because they were wiped out because it got too cold for them. I'm starting again. But the point is, it's not one thing. I have 20 or 30 things in that tiny polytunnel. So it's divided between all of them. Plus, I'm using the minimum heat. I'm using not only a double polytunnel, but the inner one has bubble plastic thrown over it in winter. And the pineapples were in a cold frame inside of that. So to tell me that I'm burning off fuel when he's buying stuff that's been flown in,
Flown in by ship.
If it's coming flown by ship, in. It's not so bad.
Yeah,
okay.
Ship is much better.
But when
than
it's flown in, it's completely different.
Yeah.
Also, what am I doing? I'm spending a little fuel because I haven't got a lot of money to spend. This is not some tropical steam house, right? This is minimum temperatures to find out what we can grow. Because my idea would be that I would like to do a deal with Sizzle, you know, Sizewell Nuclear Power Station down the road, and say, just run your cooling water through my polytunnels I'm going to put up here, and I'm going to grow pineapples on the Suffolk coast, because we could do it. You only need that background warmth for these. This is what I've discovered, is that many of these things are not so difficult to grow. Pineapples, if you root a pineapple crown, you will be producing a pineapple in 3 years. If you do well, you get it up to a bucket-sized container and a big plant, you can grow pineapples bigger than you can buy. I've done so. And they're delicious. The point is, they are feasible. People think they're not feasible. We can grow them in this country and without huge quantities of energy, because we thought they needed much more. So I'm sorry, Mr. Monbiot, but you were really rather wrong to criticise people who are experimenting and trying to find out how all of us could still have pineapples in the future when we can't bring them in from abroad because they don't have them in there anymore.
So, I'll be seeing him shortly. So,
well, give him my regards, because I think he's doing some good, but
he
shouldn't. You see, the trouble is, he's put people like my backs up, and we should all be on the same side, because we are all on the same side. Stop nitpicking about a few of us, George.
Okay. Now, you always say, Bob, plants that you grow have to be aphrodisiacs, scented or edible. So which is your best aphrodisiac?
I don't need an aphrodisiac. I need a muzzle.
You always say that, but you love aphrodisiacs.
Yeah, because one of the interesting things is they're often the rarest plants. They've disappeared from the wild because they were collected by so many people. So that makes them fascinating. There is no such thing as an aphrodisiac as such, right? I'm sure that technically, medically, there may be some. I just find it fascinating that they have this allure that they may do something. I'm far more interested in the edible and the scented. And to be honest, if you really want to persuade somebody into bed, making them laugh is far more effective than trying to drug them with some aphrodisiac. I use that line merely as a throwaway line.
It's a great one. It's a great one, Bob. We love it. We love it. So, Bob, I always bring my guest a present. So I bought you a fig plant. Now, obviously, you've got lots of figs here, but you've probably got brown turkey, have you, and a few others.
Brown turkey, the usual ones, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the best one to do is Desert King. And this comes from a fig tree found in 1930 in California. And what is so good is it's very winter hardy. It will tolerate minus 15 at night, minus 10 in the day, after 2 or 3 weeks, several weeks of it. But mostly, it is the most delicious fig,
that
I think.
That sounds a bit...
Very sweet.
I remember you were saying it on the programme, and I said I wanted one. Thank you for bringing me one.
The only thing that concerns me is I do loads of cuttings the whole time. And it's funny, because a lot of those leaves don't look very fig-like. But sometimes cuttings, when it's young, they look very different. The very new ones look very
Justin
fig-like.
Brooke, who used to grow figs over near Bury St Edmunds, reckoned that they all had distinctive foliage shapes, and you could tell which one they were from the foliage shape. And I went out and I looked at mine, and I found three different shapes on the same plant.
Yeah.
It's like mulberries, there's the one behind you. The leaves depend on the rate of growth, the time of year, and so... No, the some plants are figs related to mulberry. They're not, are they?
I don't think so.
Don't think so.
No.
It's just that they do change the shape, so I wouldn't worry about that.
No, but I'm pretty sure that must be because I love it, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I love. It doesn't have so many leaves and branches along. It's more leggy than brown turkey, but I think the taste and the productivity is far better. But
I'll
we're sort of stuck on brown turkey here, and that's the only one you hear about.
It's the hardiest. I think that's probably the one.
I don't think it's hardier than this. I think this is hardier.
But then, you see, if I go to an old garden, number of times there'll be a black Hamburg grape outside. Why? Because that was the one that they had in the greenhouse, and they took a cutting and they grew that. We grow brown turkey. Why? Because everyone has a cutting from a brown turkey. That's the reason it's there. I mean, people don't...
Not that it's best, necessarily.
No one's
tried it.
Brunswick is very similar, and I think slightly better, actually. Slightly bigger.
Anyway, it's been lovely to come and see your garden. Thank you very much for doing this. And I look forward to another bit of a fight on the next Gardener's Question Time programme with you.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl. It's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl. Happy Friday. It's Jen. Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts. Like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.